This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. U.S. President Donald Trump says a seven-day partial truce with the Afghan Taliban has been holding up, and it could eventually lead to his signing of a peace deal with the insurgent group later this week. Trump's remarks came a day after the reduction in violence truce took effect across Afghanistan, with U.S., Taliban, and Afghan forces agreeing to launch offensive operations for a week. A deadly earthquake rocked parts of Iran and Turkey. Reuters' Ciara Lee has more.
Nine people were killed and dozens injured on Sunday when an earthquake struck the southeastern Turkish province of Van. Aerial footage revealed damage to a village hit by the magnitude 5.7 quake near the border with Iran. Turkey's health ministry said three of those killed were children and 37 people were injured. The tremor caused more than 1,000 buildings to collapse, with damage some 90 kilometers to the west in the Turkish city of Van and to the east in dozens of villages in Iran. Iranian state TV said 75 people were injured, with no reported fatalities.
President Trump is on his way to India at this hour, but he doesn't expect to be returning home with a big trade deal. There is a mutual agreement on dozens of elements for the pact, but several contentious sectors are unresolved, including medical devices, according to sources close to the talks. U.S. National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien says he has not seen any evidence that Russia is doing anything to help President Donald Trump get reelected, but he acknowledged he has not sought out intelligence reports that allege Moscow is interfering in the 2020 election. For more on this or any of today's top news, go to voanews.com. This is VOA News. South Korea says there are 161 new cases of coronavirus on Monday. Officials also confirmed two more deaths, bringing its death toll to seven. Apart from the Diamond Princess cruise ship docked in Japan, South Korea has the most infections outside of China. China reported 409 new infections Monday, pushing its total number of cases past 77,000. China also reported 150 new deaths, bringing the overall toll to nearly 2,600. In Italy, more than 130 people have contracted the coronavirus, the highest number of cases in Europe. Sabina Castelfranco has more from Venice.
Military police wearing surgical masks are guarding the nearly a dozen northern Italian towns that are on lockdown following an outbreak of coronavirus. The towns have a combined population of about 50,000. The police were deployed to ensure that no one enters or leaves the towns that have been sealed and placed under quarantine. Very strict measures were adopted in the two most affected regions in Italy on Sunday, including closure of schools, universities, cinemas and museums for at least a week. In Venice, checks were being carried out at the airport on all arriving passengers and leaflets handed out with an emergency number for the health ministry and a list of precautions to take. Authorities cancelled all carnival events from Sunday. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Venice.
The Israeli military has shot two Palestinian militants trying to place an explosive device along the border with Gaza, one of whom was killed, according to a Palestinian official. AP's Zaria Shackley reports.
Israel blames the Islamic group Hamas, which rules Gaza, for ongoing fire emanating from the Gaza Strip. The Israeli military said it targeted a squad belonging to the Islamic Jihad group that previously placed explosives along the border aimed at harming Israeli troops. Islamic Jihad identified the dead as one of its fighters. Amateur video showed an Israeli bulldozer as it was lifting up an apparently lifeless body from the scene. The military said it was removing the body in a way that prevented further danger to those around. However, a spokesman for Hamas accused the Israeli military of abusing the corpse. I'm Zaria Shakili.
Iranian officials say the turnout in the country's parliamentary election Friday was around 42%. That's the lowest participation since 1979, the year of Iran's Islamic Revolution that swept the clerical rulers into power. State TV says the former mayor of Tehran was the top winner in the capital with more than 1.2 million votes. Voters had limited options on Friday's ballot. More than 7,000 potential candidates were disqualified, most of them reformists and moderates. From Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, February 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Togo's opposition coalition candidate is claiming victory in Saturday's election.
According to the results that we have, we think that we win with a total of votes, which could be between 57 and 61%.
Today is the court deadline for Malawi's parliament to come up with a 50-plus-1 electoral reform bill. A member of South Sudan's new government says all is going well so far following Saturday's transitional government formation. And Burundi launches an appeal in the East African Court of Justice.
What we said in our appeal is the violation of law that have been done by the First Instance Division in trying the case.
We'll examine women's participation in anti-colonial struggles across Africa and what's behind the sharp decline in HIV/AIDS infections in Kenya over the last 6 years. Those stories plus Samson Omale's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Togo's Electoral Commission is expected to announce today, Monday, some results from Saturday's presidential election. However, Bridget Ajamabo, the spokesperson for opposition candidate Abayomi Kojo, says opposition vote tally shows their candidate has won the election. She says the victory margin could be between 57 and 61%. Ajamabo says Mr. Kojo spoke to the nation on Sunday night that he will form an inclusive government in a few days' time. She said, judging from Saturday's massive turnout, most Togolese prefer Mr. Kojo.
I have to say that people participated very well in the election, and you could see that many voters chose to vote for Mr. Abayomi Kojo, who is the candidate of the coalition of opposition parties and civil society organizations. According to the result that we have, we are the winner of the election. We think that we win with a total of votes, which could be between 57 and 61%. And our elected president just made a statement to the Togolese population, thanking them for having voted for him and announcing that he will form a government in few days, a government which will be very inclusive, and calling Togolese people to start to celebrate the victory. We know that the Electoral Commission will announce the result tomorrow, and we are sure that the results announced will be in conformity with what we announced.
Bridget, as you said, the Electoral Commission will make the announcement on Monday, but yet you are telling me that you think that your candidate, Mr. Kojo, has won the election. What proof do you have?
Because we have collected data from our focal points that were in various parts of the country.
So you are certain or you are sure that when the results are announced, your candidate will be declared the winner?
Exactly. And if you had been here yourself, James, you would be sure that we are telling the truth. And you could see that people participated too well to the election, and they were very vigilant to stop any fraud. Despite the fraud that they organized, we are the winner of the election.
Did you say that the final results will be announced on Monday, or these are just preliminary results?
They say that they will announce it on Monday. But you know, we don't need to wait for them. We know ourselves that the way the electors, the voters participated to the election gave us the insurance, especially after analyzing the data that we got. We are sure that this year, in 2020, there will be a change in the power in Togo.
Bridget Ajamabo is the spokesperson for Togolese opposition coalition candidate Abayomi Kojo. She was speaking with us from the capital, Lome. In Malawi, the 21-day deadline set by the country's constitutional court for parliament to come up with a 50-plus-1 electoral reform bill is today Monday, but it appears a constitutional crisis may be looming, as some members of parliament last week rejected a proposed 50-plus-1 bill. In its February 3rd ruling, the constitutional court not only nullified the May 2019 presidential election results, it also directed parliament to pass a 51-plus-1 electoral reform bill by today, February 24, ahead of the July 2nd court order election. Frank Mwinifumbo is a member of the Alliance for Democracy Party of Malawi. He says anyone who believes in multi-party dispensation in terms of accountability and transparency should support the 50-plus-1 electoral reform bill.
The expectation is that members of parliament will come together, maybe iron out the differences and the understanding or misunderstanding of the bill so that they can comply with the court. From my experience, such kind of arrangements, especially when you get recommendations or orders, should I say, from the court, is that simply for a parliament to adopt. In fact, it was recognized that this 50-plus-1 already exists in our statutes. It was just a question of now coming up with the procedures on the runoff. Assuming that nobody has attained the threshold of 50-plus-1, there'll be a need for a runoff. And the parliamentarians were supposed to just come with the procedures and the rules of the runoff, not necessary to pass it into law. From my understanding, the judges say this already exists. The issue of majority already exists in our electoral laws.
What happens on Monday, February 24th? And nothing happened. I was reading where a member of the parliamentary committee in charge of this is threatening to go back to the constitutional court.
I want to believe that the parliament itself has a capacity to reach a common ground, and that is to pass the law. The laws that are actually on the floor of the House are not necessarily favoring a particular party, but they are for the good of the country in terms of unity. And I'm very sure that the emphasis from the courts, they did take into consideration to use this 50-plus-1 as a deterrent for others. To have a government that enjoys a mandate, a working majority, I think that is the essence. So I wouldn't believe that this should be to the interest of every party, especially in this democratic dispensation, that we have to have a working majority. 50-plus-1 gives you a working majority that will cast out doubts on how you acquired it. Another thing, what I want to envisage is that the courts, I think, they would like to promote unity amongst parties in Malawi, because what has happened since we attained multi-party democracy, parties have tended to shun from each other, from talking to each other on issues that of common interest in the country.
Frank Mwinifumbo is a member of the Alliance for Democracy Party of Malawi. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. Burundi has launched an appeal in the East African Court of Justice against the election of Regional Assembly Speaker Martin Ngoga of Rwanda. Burundi says Ngoga's election back in 2017 violated the treaty establishing the East African Community. Moses Javier Rimana reports from Arusha, Tanzania.
Burundi has appealed at the East African Court of Justice on the election of the East African Legislative Assembly Speaker Martin Ngoga in 2017. The Attorney General of Burundi said that the election of the speaker from Rwanda violated the treaty establishing the East African Community. Vizigiro Diomed is a state attorney from Burundi who represented Burundi's Attorney General.
What we said in our appeal is the violation of law that have been done by the first instance division. In trying the case, there is a violation of Article 53, sub-article 1, and Article 57, sub-article 1 of the treaty, and a violation of Rule 12, sub-rule 1 of the Code of Procedure.
According to Article 12.1 of the Assembly's Rule of Procedure, the quorum of the House or the Committee of the Whole House shall be half of the elected members, and such quorum shall be composed of at least one-third of the elected members from each partner state. While electing the Speaker in 2017, Tanzania and Burundi members of Parliament abstained from voting. Justin Semuyaba is a lawyer for the community.
All members of East African Legislative Assembly were called for the first meeting of the Assembly. They came here knowing that they are coming to elect a speaker. They got allowances, they slept in hotels. You came, you got sworn in on the first day. You cannot turn around and say, I was not around. The speaker was validly elected, and we have vehemently defended that position, that the current speaker of the East African Legislative Assembly was validly elected.
In the ruling of the First Instance Division in July last year, the court dismissed the reference of reasons that the applicant did not prove before the court if the election of the Speaker of the Fourth Assembly was indeed fraud with the absence of requisite quorum. Vizigiro Diomed, a state attorney from Burundi, disagrees on lack of evidence.
It is not a question of evidence before this court. The trial court had determined the case on the basis of uncontested facts between parties. And if there is uncontested facts between parties, the court cannot ask further evidence.
Both Burundi and Rwanda entered into the East African Community in 2007. This has yet again reflected the sour relation between Burundi and Rwanda. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
Today's Monday, February 24th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 minutes past the hour. Celebrations are continuing in South Sudan following Saturday's creation of the long-awaited unity government. Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel is formerly deputy military spokesman for the opposition SPLM-IO and now public relations officer for the Joint South Sudan Defense Board. He says South Sudanese are tired with fighting each other.
People are happy. The celebration all over the country, especially beginning from the day the president decreed or reverted the state to 10 from 32 plus 3 administrative areas, followed by immediately the swearing in of the past vice president and the vice president. So I think the mood in the country is very happy, especially in the Juba. People are happy and there's like a lot of celebration. What is now left is the complete formation of the government that includes nominating the ministers and also the state governors and going also down to the county commissioners and also the Kayama administrative. Politically, according to the agreement, there should be the distribution of the ministries supposed to take place. I believe by tomorrow they'll sit down and distribute the ministries, the parties, the agreement, according to the percentage that is given to or allocated to the different parties.
You said people are happy, but I'm sure also you will agree that many South Sudanese are skeptical because President Salva Kiir and your leader, Dr. Riek Machar, this is the latest of trying to bring peace. So would you agree with those who may be skeptical now that they are not sure if this is going to last?
The reason why they're skeptical is because of the incident that happened in 2015, the J1 incident. But we currently see the kind of situation that happened in 2015 is available at the moment. In 2015, we had two big forces in Juba. The force of the SPLM-IO was in Juba, 1,370, and also the Tiger Force of the government was also in Juba. But now we don't have forces in Juba, and the protection of Dr. Riek Machar is under the president himself. At the moment, Dr. Machar and all of us who are here in Juba are being protected by the National Security Unit, or maybe the Operation Unit of the National Security. So there is no way we can really clash because we don't have forces in Juba.
Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel is formerly the deputy military spokesperson for the SPLM-IO. He is now the public relations officer for the Joint Defense Board in South Sudan. He was speaking with us from Juba. What began as interviews with Namibian women who fought for independence as well as against apartheid eventually became a project by Dr. Yolande Buka, an assistant professor of political science at Queen's University, to launch into a full-blown textbook chapter on women's participation in anti-colonial fights across Africa.
That opened kind of my eyes to a series of different instances where I realized, whoa, women were there too, and women were here as well, and women participated in different ways. So when you grow up African, you often hear about the fathers of the nation. You often hear about the fathers of the independence movement, and Nkrumah, for instance, in Ghana or in Senegal, but you rarely hear about the women. So that's kind of what got me started. And so I started doing a little bit of research. I wanted to see, well, where were the women in different resistance movements across the continent? I didn't want to focus just on one country.
When we think about, you know, liberation movements, the violent struggles anyway in Mozambique, yes, there were violent struggles and the women did participate, but the women often contributed in much wider array of ways. Do you think that these contributions to the anti-colonial movement get lost sometimes in the male, quote, male version of war?
Absolutely. So, you know, I gave you the example of the homie female soldiers and the example of women who fought in Southern Africa in liberation movements as fighters. But the reality is that first, the majority, at least if we look from the 1940s all the way to the 1960s, the majority of countries didn't gain independence through armed rebellions. Right. So it was through negotiation, protest, resistance, strikes, boycotting that people put pressures on colonial authorities and the international community. And women participated in a wide variety of these types of activities. They organized, they mobilized, they fundraised.
How do you think these histories, these stories in the recent past are reflective of current political landscapes?
It's a really interesting question. I think it really depends on where you are and on the continent. In some places, there is this capacity, this kind of collective memory have retained the role that women have played in pre-colonial era and in during the colonial encounter and post-colonial politics. In other places, it almost seems like the ways in which things unfolded really erased women's participation from the collective memory.
Dr. Yolande Buka is an assistant political science professor at Queen's University. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Canada. HIV and AIDS infections in Kenya has sharply reduced in the last 6 years, according to the Kenya Population-Based HIV Impact Assessment of 2018 and 2019 survey. It indicates that Kenya's HIV prevalence stands at 4.9, as Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
According to the Kenya Population-Based HIV Impact Assessment, KEMFIA, the prevalence of HIV in women is at 6.6%, twice that in men at 3.1%. The top five HIV prevalence counties with a prevalence of more than 9% were Homa Bay, Kisumu, Siaya, Migori, and Busia, while prevalence was lowest in nine counties of Samburu, Tana River, Garissa, Wajir, Mandera, Marsabit, Kiambu, West Pokot, and Baringo. Speaking in Nairobi, Ministry of Health Chief Administrative Secretary Rashid Amani said that the current HIV strategic plans and efforts in HIV prevention are already focusing in the top five HIV prevalence counties.
The prevalence of HIV in women is at 6.6%, twice that in men at 3.1%. This gender disparity in the burden of HIV is even greater than three times in between the ages of 20 to 34 years. This data shows the ever-widening gap from the 2007 to 2012 KAIST surveys that are now showing a significantly higher burden of the disease in women compared to men.
Mr. Rashid, however, says more attention needs to be paid to the counties that have an emerging outbreak, as evidenced by the consistent rise in their HIV burden.
More attention needs to be paid to the counties that have an emerging epidemic, as evidenced by the consistent rise in their HIV burden. Among these are the counties of Turkana at 6.8% and Kisii at 6.1% prevalence.
The report also indicates that adults living with HIV in Kenya are at 1.3 million, as those aware of their status are at 80%. Homa Bay Governor Cyprian Awiti, whose county is topping in HIV prevalence in the country, has urged his people to access health centers to know their status and help in working towards HIV reduction in the area. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
It's coming up at 25 past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with some football news, where South Africa have pulled out their Olympic football team out of a friendly with host Japan due to the ongoing fears over coronavirus in the country. The South African national under-23 team were set to travel to Japan on the 27th of March, 4 months ahead of the start of the Tokyo Olympic Games for the encounter. Japan is one of the most affected countries in the world, with a total of 146 cases of the coronavirus. In Kenya, incumbent Football Association President Nick Wanwa is the only presidential nominee for the upcoming contested Football Kenya Federation elections. For the second time in 3 months, Football Kenya Federation President Nick Wanwa presented his nomination papers for the top football seat in the country. The initial polls slated for last December were cancelled by the Sports Dispute Tribunal over irregularities in the electoral board and a lack of public participation in the exercise. But Mr. Wenwa insisted he was confident of triumphing in the polls slated for next month, even if the exercises repeated several times.
We are dragging Kenya into a quagmire of elections that we do not need, because there's a clear leadership and there's clear political support.
And now to athletics news. Joshua Cheptegei has been crowned the Uganda 2019 Athlete of the Year at a colorful ceremony in Kampala. The long-distance athlete triumphed at various international events and also became the first Ugandan to win a 10,000 meters gold medal at the World Athletics Championship before registering the 5-kilometer road race world record.
But there's only one step that is separating me to becoming the greatest distance runner of all time, and of course the greatest athlete of the Ghana sport. And I believe that that's the Olympic gold, and I would not trade this year to become just like another year. This is a special year, and I got to work out everything, and I pray that the Almighty God gives me the strength to become definitely the Olympic champion.
In cricket news, South Africa's batters held their nerve to deliver a surprise 6-wicket victory over England with 2 balls to spare in the opening match at the Women's T20 World Cup in Perth, Australia on Sunday. Mignon Dupire celebrated her 100th appearance in the T20 format in the most memorable fashion imaginable when she hit a 6 and a 4 in the final over. It was South Africa's most famous victories ever and their first over England in a major ICC event. The celebrated South African batswoman Mignon Dupire was excited over their victory.
You can see the smile on my face. It's nice to finally be able to beat them in an ICC tournament. This is the 7th one I've played in, and we haven't actually gotten close. Like you mentioned, there has been a few nightmares in the past, but to finally put that behind us and to move forward is really exciting.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Today's Electoral Commission, Togo's Electoral Commission, is expected to announce today, Monday, some results from Saturday's presidential election. However, the spokesperson for the opposition coalition candidate, Abayomi Kojo, says opposition vote tally shows their candidate has won the election. Bridget Ajamabo says the victory margin could be between 57% and 61%. She says Mr. Kojo spoke to the nation Sunday night that he will be forming an inclusive government in a few days' time. That is it for this Monday, February 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, education has always formed bridges between the U.S. and Africa. A number of African leaders were educated in America. The education bond between the U.S. and the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
When news is happening,
VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.